So, Justin, how did you come to write a sports story about Marvin Gaye?
You know, that's a really good question, man. I was reading Divided Soul, which is a biography on Marvin Gaye, one of the biggest artists to ever come through Motown Records, which is one of the biggest record labels to ever happen in music.
Justin Tinsley writes about sports and culture for The Undefeated.
And within that book, there's a quick passage about how he tried out for the Detroit Lions. It just piqued my interest. I'm like, well, okay, I know about Marvin Gaye. I thought I knew a lot about Marvin Gaye, but what do you mean Marvin Gaye's history is tied with the NFL's history? I knew it would be interesting because you got this iconic artist playing this iconic American sport. It took me on a rabbit hole I never saw coming. I discovered there's a very real and legitimate statement to be said that the Detroit Lions, in particular two players, played a crucial role in not just Marvin Gaye's career, but the sound of music as a whole. And there's also a way that you could say that these two Detroit Lions saved Marvin from one of the darkest periods of his life.
Marvin Gaye's rendition of the national anthem at the 1983 NBA All-Star Game is easily his most famous sports contribution, and it is worthy of that acclaim. But the difference that sports made in Marvin Gaye's life, that's much less known. Today, how a friendship between two Detroit Lions and the Motown icon led directly to a song you know, a song that still makes waves 50 years later. And how Marvin Gaye's football obsession helped the singer through a profound change in his legendary music career. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, May 24th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by UKG. Our purpose is people. Justin Tinsley, thank you for joining me.
It's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure to be here, my man. Thank you for having me.
Well, you bring with you a story that I'm incredibly excited about, and the story that you've reported here for us about Marvin Gaye's attempt to join the Detroit Lions. I mean, where does this start?
The two main players for the Lions that this story revolves around is this guy named Lem Barney, who is an NFL Hall of Fame cornerback, and Mel Farr. But here's how the story goes. Back in the summer of 1968, Barney and Farr, they were about to start their second season with the Lions, and they had both earned Rookie of the Year honors the season before, offensive and defensive rookies of the year.
The rookie's rookie in 1967 was Mel Farr. Lem Barney was the surprise of the season to everyone except the coaches who drafted him.
Barney's playing golf at Palmer Park Golf Course in Detroit. And if you know anything about Detroit and the golf courses back then, that's where a lot of the black celebrities played, from a lot of the Motown acts, Joe Louis, so on and so forth. And Barney was a huge fan of Marvin Gaye. The attendant at the golf course told him, like, Marvin Gaye lives right here. You should go introduce yourself. He knocked on the door. He didn't know what he was going to say to him at that point. And Marvin, rather than being annoyed, was actually happy to see him. And now Barney's confused, like, oh, I didn't even know you knew who I was. And Gabe was like, oh, you're Lem Barney. He ran down his stats like it was like profootballreference.com in the late 60s. They have breakfast. They talk about sports. They talk about music. And they immediately hit it off.
I'm just wrapping my brain around this scene. So Lem Barney knocks on the door. Marvin Gaye answers. It's like the morning and they have breakfast. Does Marvin Gaye like cook him an omelet? Like this, what is happening here?
You know, when I spoke to Barney about this for the story, like he couldn't remember like what they had for breakfast, but it was the absolute best possible result. Like Barney's sitting here the entire time, like, is this really happening? But something happened though, Pablo. He was like, I gotta be somewhere. Oh, damn. Training camp.
Oh, right. I play professional football, and that's actually my job.
Exactly. Like, I got to get cross town, and I got to get there or else I'm going to be in trouble, and I'm not trying to run extra sprints during practice. So they agree to meet up. They agree to, you know, continue this friendship. Barney's racing across town to get back to the training facility where training camp is. And the first guy he sees in the locker room is his good friend, Mel Farr. And he was like, bro, where have you been at? You like, you almost missed practice. He was like, you better have a good reason for why you almost missed practice. He was like, I got the best reason. I was hanging out with Marvin Gaye. And Mel Farr is like, well, to keep it G-rated, he was like, man, get out of here. No, you didn't. He was like, trust me. I'm going to introduce all of us. They became incredibly fast friends. Like, they would hang out, you know, maybe have a beer together after practice or a game. And, you know, they would play golf together, of course, because, you know, Marvin lived right by the golf course. You know, they respected each other for what they did in terms of their talents, but there was also this really true solace and this peace and this safety that they all found within each other.
So I just want to get this completely clear, because I get that Marvin's music made them fans of him, but in terms of what drew Marvin to these guys who just showed up at his doorstep quite literally, what was that about?
The best way I can describe this is Marvin Gaye wasn't just a sports fan. He didn't just keep up with sports because he was living in a big time sports city at the time, which was Detroit. He was a fanatic. Within Detroit, he religiously attended games at Tiger Stadium. He looked at these games as escapes. And if you know anything about Marvin Gaye's life and his career, he needed escapes. Sometimes they were good. Sometimes they were counterproductive. But Marvin Gaye was constantly searching for an escape throughout his own life.
So it's 1968. And 1968, of course, one of the most turbulent years in American history.
Yeah.
And in terms of where Marvin Gaye was in his life and his career musically at that point, how would you describe that?
In 1968, for Marvin Gaye, you think, like, he just saw Martin Luther King get assassinated. Robert F. Kennedy gets assassinated. Riots are popping up all over the country. He just saw the Detroit riots in 1967 from a year before. His brother is fighting in Vietnam, and he's hearing stories about, you know, all these young black men going off to Vietnam getting slaughtered. And then Marvin, in a way, suddenly, like, feels like he's not doing enough. He's having all of these thoughts go through his head, and then he has to record, you know, these upbeat songs, happy-go-lucky songs that fit Motown's aesthetic. Because, of course, Berry Gordy, who's the founder of Motown Records, his ethos was, we're going to be the sound for young America, not just sound for young black America, but young America, period. And So Barry wasn't interested in songs that were going to push the needle politically or socially. He wanted, you know, I heard it through the grapevine and, you know, all these other, like, really upbeat and, you know, happy love songs that Motown was really iconic for, even in the moment.
And those happy love songs, Justin, I mean, they also seemed unfathomable because there was a personal tragedy weighing on Marvin Gaye at the time as well. The year before, fall 1967, Tammy Terrell, Marvin Gaye's Motown musical partner, collapsed in his arms during a performance, and she is ultimately diagnosed with a brain tumor. And Marvin is there watching as her health gets worse and worse until she ultimately passes in 1971, just shy of her 25th birthday. How did Tammy's entire struggle impact Marvin?
It would feel like a gross understatement to say he was devastated. Tammy Terrell was his world. They created such classic music together, some of the most beautiful and legendary duets, love songs that we'll ever hear in music. Songs like Ain't No Mountain High Enough, songs like You're All I Need to Get By, and Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing. So when you think about it, Marvin, who always battled with internal demons and had to we know it now is mental health. Marvin always struggled with that area of his life. So when he sees somebody so close to him, not just musically, but just as a friend, slowly succumb in front of his eyes, it really put him in a dark place. So when she passed, he lost his love for music. Marvin famously asked the question, man, like, how can I sing about love songs when the last thing on my mind is love? Because I don't see love anywhere in the world right now.
Yeah, there was that 1992 interview with Lem Barney, who talked about watching Marvin grieve during this time.
I had a chance to befriend Marvin when he went reclusive during the Tammy Terrell death. Marvin just stayed in, didn't want to do anything, and both Melfar and I would go over and try to coach him back to civilization and realization about he still has to do things. So for almost 2 years, Marvin only just stayed at home in a robe and practiced on his baby grand piano.
It's that type of mental anguish he's dealing with. And there's a quote that he said in Divided Soul, again, the biography by David Ritz, that really, really stuck out to me during the course of my reporting. And he would say, and I quote, "My phone would ring and it'd be Motown wanting me to start working. And I'd say, have you seen the paper today? Have you read about these kids who were killed at Kent State? I couldn't sleep. I couldn't stop crying. The notion of singing 3-minute songs about the moon in June didn't interest me."
So as reality is seeping more and more into his music and his aspirations for himself, what does Marvin Gaye want to become? And how does he go about becoming this next version of himself?
This is where Mel Farr and Lem Barney really come back into the story. We're in 1970. Mel and Lem and Marvin, they're all playing golf. In between holes, Marvin tells them this story of this song that had been presented to him. But it's a protest song. It was really moody. And honestly, it reflected the tension of what was going on in the country at that point in time. But Marvin didn't know if it was him. And again, protest songs were outlawed at Motown. So as Mel and Lem, they're hearing the lyrics and the themes to this song, that's when they get more and more adamant. And they were like, "Marvin, you have to do this song. You see what's going on in this country. Like, this song will reflect it perfectly." That's when Marvin is like, "Okay, I'll think about it." And so he starts reworking it on his end. He's in the studio toying with it. He finally committed to doing the song. But there was one catch. Marvin would only do the song if they would appear with him on it.
Okay, coming up, Lem Barney and Mel Farr navigate the most unexpected play call of their lives.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
All right, Justin. So Marvin Gaye has asked his friends, Lem Barney and Mel Farr of the Detroit Lions, to appear on his album. How did they react?
They reacted to it the same way you or I or anyone else would have. They was like, "No, Marvin, you playing, man. Like, yeah, that's funny, but record the song and let us listen to it and we'll give you a feedback." They thought it was a joke at first. And how could they not?
Of course. I mean, these guys are, again, football players, very good football players, not at all like musicians or singers, right?
Not at all. Like, they may be able to carry a tune, but if you're trying to carry a tune beside Marvin Gaye, it's not going to work.
So why did Marvin Gaye, one of the great musicians of all time, why did he think this was a good idea?
He saw Lem Barney and Mel Farr as two people who never tried to get anything out of him, who never tried to use him for anything. They were just two legitimately good guys that he enjoyed their friendship with. And in Marvin's eyes, he looked at it as like, you know, I might have done the song had they not convinced me, but I definitely did the song because they convinced me. And I trust them. They're a safe space for me. And the only way this song is going to feel like a safe space for me, especially considering the fact that that I'm stepping away from the norm of what Motown normally sounded like, then I need them on this song with me.
Marvin and I would ride around the city, I mean, for hours, Tom, beating on the dashboards of Rolls Royce, knocking screws and bolts out, singing music, running out of gas, having a really hitchhike, I mean, to get to a gas station. But all that led up to when we came over one night, he was in the midst of getting ready to go put this on wax. He says, guys, let's go to the studio. You take this part, Lim, you take this part.
And so what song did they show up to the studio and end up recording?
This is the wild part. This isn't just some B-side throwaway. This isn't just something that, oh, we'll leave it on the cutting room floor. Nobody will ever hear it. It's the song What's Going On. What's going on? Like, really one of the most impactful, legendary, and I know this word is thrown around a lot, iconic song.
Yes.
All time. It's What's Going On, bro. Like,
I mean, it's on the Mount Olympus of songs, right? Yes. Like, you give anybody a top 10, top 5 list of the GOAT songs ever, like, What's Going On is a pretty common response. Everybody thinks we're wrong. Oh, but who would they judge us? Simply because our hair is long. And so, how does this recording session go?
At this point, not to be cheesy and use a football reference, Marvin is the quarterback. Marvin is basically saying, all right, Mel, I need you to do this. All right, Lem, I need you to do this. When I tell you to go, just go and trust me on it. And so thankfully for Lem and Mel, they didn't have to sing. Like, Marvin had that down. He's got the singing part. When you listen to the song, What's Going On, there's a really quick intro of some guys talking. They're like, hey, what's going on? What's happening, brother?
Hey, what's happening?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like, solid, right on.
What's happening? Hey, man, what's your name?
Sweet Dennis.
That's Lem and that's Mel. So the very, honestly, even before you hear Marvin Gaye, the first two voices you hear on the song are Lem Barney and Mel Farr.
Wait. That's those two guys?
Yeah, that's them. That's them.
In the lyrics of it, the songwriting of it, the message of it, is there a passage, is there a part, a stanza that stands out to you the most?
You know, I think about this quite often, man, and It's the verse that goes, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate.
Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love.
Now, on the surface, you look at it, you said war is not the answer, where you think about the Vietnam War. But when you look deeper below the surface, it was actually a plea to his own father, somebody he desperately wanted to win approval from and never got that from. And his father, in many senses, was his lifelong antagonist. You can understand where a lot of these demons and vices come from when your father's always telling you, oh, if you sing this music, you're not living the way God would want you to. This is a son fleeing for love from his father.
So Justin, this song gets released to the public in the spring of 1971. And as you say, very clearly, this is a shift. It's a shift tonally. It's a shift in subject matter for Marvin Gaye. What was the rollout around this song like, and how was it received?
In 1971, as you just said, this represented not just a gradual shift. This was an immediate and direct shift in terms of the sound of Motown. And it wouldn't have been that big of a deal had Marvin told Berry Gordy where he was going with this. Like, Marvin just said, look, I'm going to record it. I'm going to ship this thing out the radio. I'm not going to tell Berry Gordy. And the wild thing is, Berry Gordy didn't hear the song until after it was already shipped out. And he was like, what the hell is this? Like, this is not what we're doing. But the song ended up becoming the fastest selling single in Motown. And it just completely made Berry Gordy eat his words. It wasn't the first protest song, but it was the one that redirected the course of popular music, that told artists, like, yo, you can make concept music. You can make concept albums and apply it to the life that you see outside this studio and have it be a success. And that's why it's still going to resonate today. And that's why that album and that song will always resonate. What's wild about this collaboration is, in many ways, it was just a continuation of Marvin's relationship with the Lions, because the wild thing is, Pablo, this story's only halfway done.
All right, after the break. So Marvin Gaye has welcomed the Lions into his domain, but it's soon going to be time for the Lions to return the favor.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
All right, Justin. So Marvin Gaye has surprised Lem Barney and Mel Farr by asking them to be on one of the most iconic songs of all time. But that was not the only surprise somehow that this guy had in store for the two of them, because what did he tell them that he wanted to do next?
Okay, so now Marvin was like, all right, so y'all were teammates with me in the studio. Now I want to be teammates with y'all. And so again, Lem and Mel are like, what's going on here? And that, like, no pun intended, what's going on? They came to learn that Marvin was dead serious about playing professional football.
Like in the NFL, professional football.
There were no video game systems. Marvin couldn't create himself on Madden. He wanted to be in the game, because Marvin saw this as an extension of their brotherhood. He really saw these guys, you know, as long lost brothers.
Wait, hold on a second here. Because Justin, the people in Marvin's life who know of his aspirations here,
yeah,
what are they telling him as he is saying now that he wants to become a real life Detroit Lion?
So he tells Smokey Robinson. Smokey Robinson said, dude, you're insane. Probably in more colorful language, but he said, dude, you're insane. And so now he's telling his brother Frankie that, yeah, I want to try out for the Lions. I want to play in the NFL. And this is Marvin Gaye's quote to his brother when Frankie asked him, like, why the hell are you even thinking about doing this? And he says, and I quote, I'd rather catch a pass and score a touchdown in Tiger Stadium than rack up another gold record. Like, this dude was serious about this, man. He was very serious about this. Think about this. You got a 31-year-old with no athletic experience whatsoever trying to play in the NFL. This sounds like the plot line from a yet-to-be-filmed Kevin Hart movie.
It's absurd. Like, at the very least, when you step into a studio and you have no musical training, like, your life isn't at risk.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, like, what are the actual football players? What are Barty and Farr? What are they telling Marvin when they hear that this is his plan now?
You know, credit to Mel and Lem, because, you know, when you got homeboys, your homeboys will tell you, like, man, I don't think this is a good idea. But I'm a ride out with you. Like, if you want to try it, like, it ain't going to cost me anything. Marvin, like, truly dedicates himself to this. Like, he ran multiple miles a day with Mel and Lem. Like, he was really taking this seriously. Now, in their minds, they understood that, like, it's great that he's getting in shape, but he's still not going to make the team. In Marvin's eyes, he's thinking, like, yo, bro, this is my chance to make the NFL. Like, I'm really going to do this. So they take the idea to the team.
Yeah, so how does that go?
The funny thing about it was when I spoke to Joe Schmidt, who was the coach of the Lions at the time, he was really funny telling this story. There's this sequence of them going to Coach Schmidt, and they're like, hey, I want to run something by you and just see what you think.
It was Lem. Can I bring Marvin Gaye out to practice? Well, I guess so. But he said he would like to practice, see if he could make the team. I said, no. How can Marvin Gaye make the team, man? He says, well, he likes football and he can run. I said, well, that doesn't make a football player. I like to sing and I can't sing. So
the guy likes football and he can run. Yeah, that's not quite enough to get a head coach legitimately interested.
Like, not Marvin Gaye, Marvin Gaye, not Motown, Marvin Gaye, not You're All I Need to Get By, Marvin Gaye. It was like, yeah, coach, he wants to try out for the team. And see, the thing is, we kind of told him he could get one. It was like, what? And so eventually, man, they convinced him to do it. Schmidt even then couldn't even really articulate why he had a change of heart and was like, all right, just tell him to come on. You know what I mean? Like, just tell him to come out here. Like, I can't guarantee you anything. And when I spoke to Lem Barney about this moment, like, he got really, really excited. Even over the phone, you could see the smile on his face. He remembers the phone call vividly with Marvin, and I'll read it out to you. So Barney calls Marvin Gaye, and Barney's like, guess what? Marvin's like, what's up? What is it? Barney's like, Coach Schmidt wants to meet you. Marvin Gaye loses it. He was like, I knew this is it. This is my shot. Don't drive. I'll come by and pick you up in the limo. He was just so fired up, and he put on, you know, a three-piece suit, and not obviously not the trial, but he wanted to make a good impression to Coach Schmidt. Like, he was really serious.
You know, as a casual free agent to be does, you wear your three-piece suit and you show up to the football team. Sure.
Yeah, like, Coach Schmidt, I'm ready to play. And so, you know, he talks with Schmidt. And of course, you know, he's a really nice guy and they have a great conversation. But the thing is, Schmidt figured Marvin played football at some point in time. Like, he didn't have any footage from college because he never attended college. He didn't have any footage from high school because he didn't play in high school. He dropped out at 17 and enlisted in the Air Force. So Schmidt's like, I assume he at least played in high school.
It's worth mentioning, too, here, like, Joe Schmidt, the head coach of the Lions, that dude is a Hall of Famer. Like, he is no joke. He's a serious dude. So when he relents and says, all right, let's give Marvin Gaye a tryout, what did this tryout really look like and how did Marvin Gaye do?
So the tryout itself, it was about in front of like 20 people on the field and in the bleachers combined. It's important to note that before the tryout officially started, Marvin said a prayer with Lem Barney and Mel Farr. Like, that's how important this was to him. Marvin tried out for several positions, including running back and tight end and wide receiver and fullback. Coach Schmidt, who recalled the tryout, man, this dude acted like a consummate pro, doing whatever Coach Schmidt asked him, lining up wherever he needed to. Like, this dude was very coachable. You know, if nothing else, you could say Marvin Gaye was not a diva when it came to, like, being a football player.
Of course, everybody got a big kick out of it. But the guy, you know what? He could run pretty good. couldn't catch that well, but you know, it was something different. The team got a kick out of it, and I'm sure he enjoyed it.
Schmidt didn't have anything bad to say about that, but you know, in his own mind, like, this dude, he cringed at the thought of putting him at wide receiver and making him run across the middle and meet people like Deacon Jones or Chuck Howley or Dick Butkus. Like, he couldn't live with himself if Dick Butkus took Marvin Gaye's head off across the middle. He couldn't be seen as the guy that ruined Marvin Gaye's career because he actually, hey, go block Deacon Jones and see how that works out for you. You know, that just wasn't going to work for him. Look, he told him, like, Marv, look, I love you. I love your attitude.
I think I just told him, I said, you know, you can see now that you have some ability, but, you know, not good enough to play professional football. And glad you came out, and everybody enjoyed your presence. And thanks for coming out, and, you know, lots of luck.
And Lem and Mel understood that.
They did pretty good, you know, after working out with Mel and I and hanging out with us and going to the games and really getting involved in it. But he just didn't have what it took to get him over the hill.
Marvin was a little disappointed. He was a little upset about that. But, you know, he was ultimately appreciative of just the opportunity. And, you know, Coach Schmidt told me he thinks that sort of satisfied his desire to play professional sports. Like, he had a tryout. Not everybody can say they have a tryout. Regardless of whatever you want to say about the level or the intensity of that tryout, that man got a tryout in front of a professional football coach.
And even more than that, Justin, what your reporting is showing is that that whole effort to make the team, that truly refocused Marvin Gaye, at least for a time.
So if you know anything about Marvin Gaye, you know that drug abuse, drug addiction was unfortunately a frequent chapter throughout his life. And in particular, you know, bouts with cocaine, battles with drinking, and, you know, things of that sort. But for this period in time of Marvin's life, when he had a goal to chase after, when he had a goal that he really wanted to achieve, and that was to play professional football in the NFL, he kicked all of that to the curb. Like, he picked up weightlifting multiple times a day. He picked up cardio multiple times a day. He was truly getting himself into what he believed football shape looked like, because this was his chance. This was his chance to prove to himself that, yo, I run my life on my own terms, and this is what I want to do. And in a way, you have Lem Barney and Mel Farr to thank for that.
So in the years right after What's Going On and that unsuccessful football tryout, Justin, Marvin Gaye became Marvin Gaye. I mean, Let's Get It On, that came out in 1973. Sexual Healing came out in 1982. That revolutionary performance of the national anthem, that was 1983. But at the same time, as all of that was happening, Marvin Gaye's drug abuse, the other issues plaguing him throughout his life, they reemerged and became progressively worse. Did Lem Barney and Mel Farr stay in touch with Marvin as that was happening and as his star rose?
The last time they saw him was in June 1983 in Detroit. It was on the last tour of Marvin's life. They saw Marvin perform. He put on a great show. But I remember Mel Farr telling me this in our interview. And he says, and I quote, after the performance, we go back to his dressing room. And he had all those hangers on, giving him this drug and this drug. And I said, wow, man, I don't think he's going to make it. It was that bad. Lem and I, we felt for him. These were people taking advantage of him. And there was nothing we could do. There weren't cell phones back then. And it was difficult trying to get to him because everybody was around him. You know, it was nothing they could do to save Marvin. And for a long time, and I could tell when I spoke to Mel Farr about this, his voice got really quiet for a second, and he was really sad.
Those concerns that Barney and Farr had for Marvin Gaye, Justin, they were incredibly real, but they also didn't foresee the specific tragic way that Marvin Gaye's life would come to an end in 1984, because Marvin Gaye's father, the man you had called his lifelong antagonist, he shot and killed his son in the middle of a dispute.
Marvin Gaye was visiting his parents' home here in Los Angeles. There was a family argument. The singer was shot in the chest. A little while later, Marvin Gaye died.
Marvin Gaye Jr. was taken to California Hospital, where he was pronounced dead from gunshot wounds at 1 o'clock this afternoon.
So as the years pass, Justin, and Barney and Farr are left with just the memory of their idol who somehow became their friend, how do they remember Marvin Gaye? How do they remember the wild story of that friendship?
They love Marvin Gaye, man. They love him. They love him. He was somebody that changed their lives, because his music had already changed their lives. But then that friendship with him changed their lives.
I'll oftentimes roll down a window when I hear a tribute to Marvin on the radio and scream up in the air, "Marvin, I love you."
There is a deep and genuine and eternal bond in love and brotherhood between Marvin Gaye, Lem Barney, and Mel Farr that not even death could break.
Justin Tinsley, thank you for reporting this story that still means so much today.
Thank you for having me on here to talk about it. Pleasure is all mine.
May 21st marked 50 years since the release of What's Going On. And you can find a link in today's show notes for the SE featured TV piece on this story, as well as Justin Tinsley's original 2015 article for The Undefeated. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.